Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Annika Harry. She's a performer, writer, and a freelance producer with serious journalistic integrity and comedy bones. Her debut book, Gender Rebels, 50 Influential Cross-Dressers, Impersonators, Name Changers, and Game Changers, is out now. It's a highly anticipated book in the feminist, queer, comedy, and women's history worlds. It's already an Amazon bestseller in various categories, including feminist criticism, women's history, and gay and lesbian biography. Annika, how would you describe yourself? A performer? A writer?
A performer, a writer, a presenter, and sometimes freelance producer. It's easier, I guess, just to say freelance creative type. There was a point in my life where I didn't even understand that you could be all of these things. And I think, especially in the last few years, I've really owned that. And I'm proud of the multi-hyphen method, as I think Emma Gannon calls it.
And how did you get to that point? I know you were born in the West Midlands, but what was your route through to all of these various creative strings to your bow?
Well, my book's actually dedicated to my nan. I think my nan is the reason why I am how I am. She was an artist. Her job was working in the art department as a tracer in the Motor Industry Research Association, and she'd draw all sorts of intricate plans for new car parts. And I spent hours and hours, summers and summers with my nan, writing, drawing, making, creating. She had a huge imagination, and I sort of feel like I owe everything to her in a way. She instilled that creativity and imagination in me, and I pursued it for my entire life. Even from childhood, I knew that was the direction I wanted to go. As I say, I wasn't entirely sure what that meant at the time, but I trained as an actor. I went to drama school and sort of got into the industry that way.
Mm-hmm. And then did you work as an actor?
Yes, so I graduated from drama school and was a jobbing actor, which, you know, for most people coming out of drama school means working in call centres and standing under golf sales signs for quite a large chunk of the time. I worked as an actor, but I didn't enjoy the sort of quote-unquote straight actor roles. In fact, I was told by an agent at the time that I was not attractive enough to play the leading lady and too attractive to play the leading lady's funny best friend. And, you know, even the funny best friend part wasn't interesting to me because they weren't that funny. And I sort of got to the end of my tether with going up for roles that I just thought weren't well written enough or were boring. And the roles for women, they were few and far between. And so that sort of pushed me into comedy, because I'd always enjoyed comedy, but I worked out that it was an area where I could just be silly and get to play around with costumes and accents and pull my face around a little bit, and I didn't have to take myself so seriously. So I started doing a lot of improvisational roles, hidden camera, and I loved all of that because it gave me freedom and a little bit of control, especially when I could do writer-performer parts. And that's where I think I realised the power of writing and how important that skill was for me to pursue.
Mm. I want to obviously talk about your writing, but I'm first just really interested in just exploring hidden camera work and sort of prank show type stuff a little bit. Tell me about how that works.
Well, so you basically, it's like do or die. You have to just go for it. And I found myself in all sorts of random and hilarious situations. And you sort of have this out-of-body experience where you look in on yourself in this situation, playing this character, pulling the wool over multiple people's eyes. And there is this sense, it's like you just have to survive it and keep going. But the fun that you get from it is, I just love it. It's been like one of the highlights of my career doing those sorts of jobs, because as I say, it's fun. And in the acting jobs that I was getting in the run-up to that weren't. They were just always usually like the mute, or in fact, I used to go to castings for plays and TV shows and improvise around the script before I got into this comedy world. And it often got me in trouble, especially if the writer was in the room. But I just wanted a bit more fun with it. I wanted that freedom.
And of course, then you built and built on that, because your writing career is now, do you think it's fair to say that that's the major strand of what you do?
At the moment, definitely. And in a way, it's been born out of, you know, all those frustrations that I just described, but equally passions for subjects. And particularly now with my first book with Gender Rebels, that was just a subject that I needed to explore and put out there. And I think oftentimes my work is born out of like just the need to do it. And it's either I'm frustrated with something and I want to explore it, or, you know, somebody's told me I can't, never tell me that I can't do something, because then I will doggedly pursue it.
Because, of course, you've been an activist too.
Yeah, you know, actually, before I wrote the book, I always, the term activist sat a little bit uncomfortably with me, because I, you know, I hadn't changed any laws. I didn't feel like I'd done anything significant enough to accept that title, if you like. But I've realised, especially writing the book and over recent times, and obviously with the current situation, that actually sometimes the smallest acts of activism can have the biggest impact. And I think at the minute, especially, I've realised the secret ingredient to thinking that you can help rather than feeling helpless is a sense of power. And people nowadays, you know, in this pandemic, they're thinking, well, I do have the power to make somebody smart today, or to go and collect somebody's groceries, or whatever it may be. You know, the lady that started the Clap for Carers, she just tweeted about it one night over a couple of glasses of wine, forgot about it, woke up the next morning and she started a national movement which has united the country. I just love all of that sort of stuff, and it's made me look at activism in a different way.
Well, let's talk about your book, Gender Rebels. Now, it has 50 women in the book. How did you go about choosing which women to put in there?
Well, some of them are potentially well known to people like the Bronte sisters, Hua Mulan, Joan of Arc, George Eliot. And so they're stories that have always been known to me, particularly George Eliot, actually, because we were both born in the Netons, in the Midlands, as you said at the top. And so her story was a part of my childhood, if you like. And I think in that sense, it was always kicking about in the back of my brain, wondering what other women are having the same experience, or have had the same experience of having to masquerade as a man to get ahead in this life. And, you know, how many more women are there out there that aren't as well known as somebody like George Eliot? But to be honest with you, the stories of these sorts of women that were deep buried in the history books and in the past, I had to go with who I found. And anybody sort of considered other by historians or history was buried quite deeply. So I was really sort of digging through the archives at the British Library and blowing dust off books to try and find them.
Because the subtitle here is 50 Influential Crossdressers, Impersonators, Name Changers and Game Changers. And that's a wide sweep. Who resonates most strongly with you in the book?
You know, there's so many stories in there, and there's so much hope and love, as well as shocking, shocking stories. Women who were wrongly enslaved, sectioned, imprisoned, even executed for their activism and just for trying to live their life. I imagine I'm going to get this question quite a lot, and I feel like my answer changes every day. But at the moment, I'm thinking a lot about one of the modern day examples, which is a DJ named Tatiana Alvarez. And I think it's because, you know, as a creative, we're all trying to find new ways of working and like overcoming obstacles at the minute. And she did. She's now one of the top international DJs for electronic dance music in the whole world. But her story to get there was a very rocky road. And she got there because she had to pretend to be a man to do so. And it was born out of frustration for her as well. She was, you know, playing all female lineups as a DJ for all female sakes. She was being told by her management she was just booked to look pretty rather than for her talents. She tried to put a mixtape out anonymously with an underground publicist in New York, and it was shared among the bookers, and it got rave reviews until they found out that she was a she, and then everybody backtracked. So she came up with this completely different persona called Matt Musette, or DJ Musicals. She's got a 5'9" stature and a makeup artist friend who helped her to create the appearance of an Adam's apple and apply a fake beard and what have you. She even set up a fake management on email so she could book gigs for DJ Musicals. And DJ Musicals was a smash success on the scene. And after a couple of years, she eventually let go of that disguise because she had to. It was holding her back and it was making her miserable. But it proved to people that she was as good as, if not better, than some of her male counterparts. And now she's, you know, she regularly headlines in some of the world's biggest festivals around the world.
That's extraordinary that she had to be a man to do so. And you know what? It's not a unique story. I think that's something that really we've seen time and time again.
Well, this is it. And I think, you know, I've already started to get the books out on June the 1st, and a few people have read it already and have been sending messages. And the response I'm getting is, oh, I've experienced this on some level. You know, you might not have to have strapped your boobs down in a too tight sports bra and put a wig on to go to work, but perhaps you've changed your email signature to a more gender neutral name in a male dominated industry, or, you know, it isn't always as cut and dry as having to do a whole disguise. But I know I feel that I have to, you know, change myself sometimes to feel safe. For example, walking home after dark, I might throw a hood up and change my gait. You know, we are still trying to negotiate this quote-unquote man's world.
Absolutely. I remember in my early days in radio, speaking to somebody at the head of a very big commercial station who told me that although he liked my work, he couldn't possibly use me because men don't want to hear their music played by a woman.
Oh, it's infuriating. You know, and actually, I spoke a bit about George Eliot being an inspiration for the book, but also I was trying to get an all-female sketch show that I'd written away a couple years ago, and I was going into TV commissioners' offices only to be told that I couldn't make it because essentially I was the wrong gender. They were looking for male-skewing programming, whatever that meant, or, oh, we really like this all-female sketch show, Annika, but would you consider putting Jack Whitehall in it? Like, that's not really the point. And there's this misconception, isn't there, that men and boys don't want to read, watch or listen to work made by women or about women. But, and it still happens, like you say, it's still happening now.
Yeah. I want to just quickly pick up on another couple of people in the book. Let's talk about Lily Hitchcock Coit. Now, she was a firewoman.
That's correct. Well, actually, she was an honorary fireman. So she lived between 1843 and 1929. And so then firefighters were men and only ever men. So she was born in San Francisco into quite a wealthy family. And at the time, San Francisco was basically built out of wood, which made it quite the fire hazard. And Lily was rescued as a child. Her and her family were rescued from a hotel fire by a group of volunteer firemen called the Knickerbocker Number Fives, which I love. It always reminds me of that Mambo Number Five song. So she basically became obsessed with firemen from there on in. And she took it one step further in 1858, where she didn't just step outside of her house every time she heard the fire bell to cheer on the boys. She actually helped in a rescue. And from there on in, she became a patroness and the sort of mascot for the Knickerbocker Number Fives that they never knew that they needed or wanted. And she supported them for her entire life. And basically, what it taught her, like years of running after the fire trucks, lifting up trailing skirts, taught her that her female garments were holding her back. So in later life, she started to dress in male garments, trousers, and she smoked cigars, and it allowed her the freedom that women didn't have then. So she melded in men's spaces. She went to casinos. She was brilliant at poker. She'd come away with her pockets full of cash. She learned to shoot guns and to ride horse and carriages. And she did all of this because she understood, as I said, it gave her a freedom and an agency to do so. And Lily's a nice example, actually, because in 2004, San Francisco got its first female fire chief, somebody called Joanna Hayes White, and she became the first female fire chief, and she actually honoured Lily in her opening speech. So it shows you, you know, how these women paved the way.
Saraswati Rajamani was an Indian freedom fighter and a spy. Tell us about her.
That's right. So Saraswati was born in 1928 and she only died a couple years ago in 2018. And actually, again, she's only a story that we know about because in the last couple years of her life, a Hindi channel about invisible female stories put her story out there. Otherwise, it might have been just buried completely by time. So she was born into a family of freedom fighters in Burma or Myanmar now. And her dad owned a gold mine. So they were pretty rich and they were the richest Indians actually in the country. But Saraswati was not interested in any of that at all. She just was obsessed with justice and freedom for her country. And she... long story short, she managed to twist the arm of the Indian National Army leader to allow her into the army. And so at 15, she became probably India's youngest spy as a part of the Rani Laxmi Bai, which was the world's first all-female army. And ironically, even though it was the world's first all-female army, women had to get the permission of a man to join, a husband or father, and also they had to largely dress as men to be able to do their jobs. So Saraswati dressed as an errand boy that she called Manny, quite apt, and she spent her time infiltrating British camps and bringing back information to the Indian National Army. She was actually injured in the process. She was on the front line for a couple of years. And by the time she got home after the war, her family had given everything they owned to the cause. And she was basically left destitute. She didn't get the life of a venerated veteran freedom fighter that she deserved. And it wasn't till the last few years of her life where she eventually had to ask for help from the government, which she was given. And as I say, then that the Hindi channel put her story out there, and it's the only reason we know about her.
Fascinating profiles, and there are 47 others. We've only heard three. It's a wonderful and really timely book. I mean, I think all of these women lived their lives in some kind of isolation, rather like we're doing now.
That's it. And, you know, I think whether that's hiding behind a fake beard or a fake name or, you know, having to hide their sexuality or seeming gender identity, they all lived some form of isolation. Some of them quite literally were, you know, hiding out and living underground, if you like.
Have you had your own gender rebel moments?
I think the rebellion side of things, so the gender rebellion, it can be the smallest little thing. So I know it's a privilege, but I like to, and I'm able to, dress how I like, which is often eclectic. You know, love who I choose, say what I like. Sometimes in terms of aesthetics, because it often comes down to that, people might comment and say that I'm looking particularly girly one day or particularly tomboyish the next. And I personally feel a little irritated by both of those charges, if you like. I think they're outdated, and that's just because we're sort of shrouded in these gender stereotypes. And I think just by dressing how I like from one day to the next feels like a small rebellion in a way.
And finally, I know that you have benefited in a small way. You have an emergency COVID grant from the Society of Authors, and you're going to use this to write your first novel.
That's correct. And thank you for mentioning it, because I'd like to thank them publicly. So thank you for that. It came at the very best time. I know there's lots of artists and writers struggling at the moment. I asked for it to write my first novel, and I am in the process of planning it at the moment. I do have a little bit of isolation sludge brain, which is it's not something I've really had to navigate before, like a lack of concentration I'm struggling with. But I think I'm good with the plotting. When it comes to the writing, that'll be the next hurdle. But for now, I'm really enjoying the plotting.
Annika, thank you so much. Gender Rebels by Annika Harry is published in paperback by Little A. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.